The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia online. I'm Sheldon Bonovitz, a proud supporter of the Free Library through tonight's Jill and Sheldon Bonovitz Endowed Lecture. The author event series is made possible only through support from caring individuals like you. Please consider a gift of whatever you are able and helping the Free Library advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity for all Philadelphians. It's my sincere privilege to introduce Joby Warwick to you this evening. Warwick won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction for Black Flags, which the San Francisco Chronicle called a revealing, riveting, and exquisitely detailed account of the rise of ISIS and its mastermind's life and death. He also won the 1996 Pulitzer for Public Service for his contribution to a series about the devastating effects of factory farming on the southeastern United States. A reporter at the Washington Post for the past 25 years, Warwick is also the author of The Triple Agent, the narrative nonfiction story of a 2009 suicide bombing that killed seven CIA employees in Afghanistan. His newest book, Red Line, is a true life thriller that details the largely unreported American effort to find and destroy Syria's chemical weapons. Warwick writes, when the bold adventure to remove all chemical weapons from Syria was taking place, Bashar al-Assad, with the help of Russia, was solidifying himself as the undisputed leader of Syria. The National Review has said, Warwick's vivid portraits of so many of the diverse individuals involved, from victims to American engineers and UN investigators, provide a devastating perspective on the civil war in Syria. I'm so pleased to have Joby here with us this evening. Joby, the screen is yours.
Thank you very much, Sheldon. I really appreciate that. And I'm grateful for the introduction and for all that you and your wife do to support the Free Library and the greater arts community in Philadelphia. I had actually very deep ties in Philadelphia, including college. I went to Temple University as a student. My first professional jobs were in the Philadelphia area, including at the Inquirer. And I married into a Philadelphia family, so I still maintain roots here. I love the city. It's great to be back, even if only virtually. And one of the things I've missed about Philadelphia being away is the vibrancy and the cultural richness of its libraries. And these are institutions whose stories are really part of the Philadelphia story. And I know everybody who watches tonight understands the importance of supporting this place, especially in these challenging times. So thank you so much for tuning in. So I'm going to talk a little bit tonight, and I'm going to share some photos because I know what it's like to have to stare at a screen. It's not as much fun as it used to be to do book talks. So I'm going to tell a little bit of the story of the book as we look at some pictures of some of the places and individuals involved. For the next few minutes, I want you to come with me to a place that, if we're honest, most Americans would prefer not to think about. A country that it truly is one of the most tragic places in the entire world. A country devastated by civil war, and a particularly brutal one. And I want you to imagine how things might have been even worse, far worse. Here's a country and a conflict that has unleashed so many terrible things, from unthinkable suffering and hardship to the human tide of refugees and all the instability triggered by those waves of desperate people fleeing for their lives, to the tens of thousands of radicalized young men and women who've rushed into the country and became even more radicalized and also battle-hardened, to the terrorist groups who drew life from this place, including the one we call ISIS. Consider all that, and now imagine how it might have been, and indeed nearly was, even worse. Imagine that this country also happens to be home to a weapon of mass destruction, highly sophisticated, extremely lethal nerve agents that rank among the deadliest substances ever made. There's tons of the stuff. It's scattered around the country. It's portable. It's an international terrorist dream, and it's potentially up for grabs in a country riven by civil war and where the government is losing territory and appears to be at imminent risk of a complete collapse. This is the reality in Syria in 2013. On top of everything, In addition to all the horrors, this is the nightmare that's being pondered and studied and agonized over by Syria's neighbors, Israel, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and also in the West for the United States, for NATO, our European allies. It was, as one American intelligence analyst describes it in the book, like watching a freight train coming. This is the background for the story I tell in Red Line. It's a book that on one level tries to give context for what really is a collective failure, a failure by everyone, the international community writ large, to resolve the Syrian conflict. All of our efforts fell short. And yet there was one issue that brought the world's countries together, at least briefly, and that was chemical weapons. What can we do about them? How can we get rid of them? How can we punish and hold accountable those who use them? It should be stipulated up front that if you're a Syrian, the focus on chemical weapons is mystifying. For some, it's infuriating. People are dying from every day from bullets, artillery shells, barrel bombs. Why this outsized interest on just one means of killing people? And yet it's also clear that these weapons are different. They pose a unique danger, including to Syrians. To this day, the biggest one-day death toll for the entire war came on one August morning in 2013, when 1,400 Syrian civilians died in a single attack because of one weapon, sarin. So in the book, the chemical attacks and the world's response to them become a narrative thread that tries to explain what happened in Syria. The book describes how we collectively managed to get one thing right, or largely right, the elimination of 1,300 tons of chemical weapons in the middle of a civil war was a remarkable feat of arms control, and nothing like it had ever happened before. But again, it's a success that takes place against a larger backdrop of failure. The war didn't end. Assad remained in power, and his ability to use other instruments of cruelty against his countrymen continued and still continues. As the story unfolds, the choices faced by the major players, the White House, the UN, Europeans, these become wrenchingly clear, and those are described in the book. But besides the players and the decision makers we know about, the Obamas, the Putins, the Assads, there are other actors less familiar who face critical choices and end up playing outsized roles. There are victims and villains, spies and scientists, terrorists and diplomats, ship captains and engineers, activists and housewives and mothers. Some face challenges heroically, even in the face of danger and futility. It was the stories of these more ordinary people that drew me to writing this book, and much of the Red Line is about them. So let's take a few minutes to meet some of them. It all starts with a laboratory, not just any laboratory, a military research facility whose purpose is to create a weapon of mass destruction for Syria's dictator. In this lab, we meet a most unusual scientist, a man who was educated in the United States, who loves America, and then returns home to become first a weapons scientist and then a top researcher in a secret program designed to make lethal nerve agents such as sarin. If you read the excerpt that ran in Washington Post last week, you're familiar with the story of Ayman, the spy. He's a bit quirky. He's a guy who decided to be married to two women at the same time. It's something you're allowed legally to do in Syria, but it's very unusual for a professional and certainly for someone of his class. He talks about his odd family configuration to a visiting American in this snippet from the book. He seemed compelled to justify his living arrangements, as another man might explain an extravagant impulse purchase. His first wife was an excellent cook, he said, but he decided to marry a second, considerably younger woman, his secretary, out of a purely carnal attraction. Who could have foreseen such turmoil? The two women squabbled constantly, except from the times when they united to direct their scorn at him. He had wanted a spicier love life, and ended up with a case of perpetual heartburn. I don't recommend it, he said to his friend. But Ayman wore yet another hat. He was a spy for the CIA. He was recruited in the late 1980s and he passed secret information to the Americans for more than a decade. And one day he decided to give his CIA handler a sample of his wares, a vial containing deadly sarin that the CIA could take home and analyze. The transfer, as it's described in the book, takes place in the front seat of a car. After a brief exchange of pleasantries, the scientist produced a small package. It's nearly Christmas. You're a Christian, the chemist said, handing over the bundle. Here's a Christmas present. A few minutes later, the American was left alone to ponder what was inside the parcel's plain wrapping. Ayman was ultimately betrayed, and how and why that happened, well, I won't spoil the ending, but the story takes a dramatic twist in a way that seals Ayman's fate. But years later, when a brutal civil war erupts in Syria, the Americans understand very well the hidden danger that exists in Syria. The information from the spy makes clear that this conflict is different from other uprisings that were part of the Arab Spring revolutions in 2011, 2012. And underground bunkers scattered throughout Syria is enough sarin to fill several swimming pools. With the country unraveling, this weapon is a grave threat to Syrians and to the entire world. Later in the book, we meet this man, an army chemical weapons expert named Tim Blades. Tim is a colorful character. He's gruff and profane, cantankerous. He has literal physical scars from accidental exposures to chemical weapons in his youth. But he's kind of the Ray Donovan of the chemical weapons business. If chemical weapons are discovered in the United States or around the world, it's him and his team that go in and try to figure out how to make it disappear. In late June 2012, Pentagon officials are struggling with what to do with the chemical weapons in Syria, and they decide to meet with Tim. If somehow the Americans can get their hands on all these chemicals, how can they get rid of them? Tim thinks it over. He says, I have an idea. He huddles with his team in Edgewood, Maryland, and in a few weeks, they have blueprints for a prototype. It's a portable machine that can fit inside two tractor trailers and can be set up almost anywhere in the world. The machine neutralizes sarin irreversibly, and the construction costs are less than it takes to build a single army tank. Tim builds this contraption. Some would start to call it the Margarita machine. It works. The Pentagon orders seven of them, and they go into a warehouse in Maryland. No one thinks they'll ever actually be used. Tim complains about this one day to his wife in the book. We paid a lot of money to build seven of these things, he said, and we're never going to use them. But then, bam, was I ever wrong. In the middle of 2013, there are reports coming out of Syria that the Assad's government is starting to experiment with small-scale attacks using chemical weapons. Little pinpricks here and there, pushing against the red line as if to see what would happen. The response is outrage and a demand for answers. And it's in this context that we meet Ekke Sällström. Sällström is a Swedish medical professor who happens to be one of the world's foremost experts on chemical weapons. He's a veteran of weapons inspection teams in Iraq. He's also a pacifist, and he knows if he finds evidence of a war crime, there might be consequences. The conflict could expand and intensify. One night, while he and his team are in Damascus, there's a horrific new attack in the outskirts of the capital. The UN inspectors actually witness the attack as it's underway. The artillery rockets launched from the northern hills arc over central Damascus, landing on targets to the east and the south. When dawn breaks, it's clear that this was no ordinary attack. More than 1,000 people were killed by poison gas, many of them small children still in their pajamas. Sällström's immediate impulse is to go to the crime scene and collect evidence. This is the reason he came to Syria in the first place. But his very presence in Syria becomes a controversy. The Syrians don't want him roaming around looking for evidence. President Obama wants him out because he's preparing a missile strike and Sällström is in the way. But the Swede continues to insist, and eventually he wins permission to leave Damascus and go with his team to the rebel towns where the attacks took place. But he goes unarmed, on his own, no military escorts, no security. There's a moment early on in their expedition where the UN team's convoy is preparing to cross into no man's land. All of a sudden, the lead vehicle comes under attack. Bullets smack against the car's frame, the tires, the passenger windows, the windshield. The glass is shatterproof and is designed to hold up against small arms fire, but only to a degree. Now it's starting to crack and widen. The UN convoy quickly turns around and heads back to a military outpost to figure out what to do. The narrative picks up at the point where Sällström and two of his advisors are discussing what happens next. Mohammed Kafaji was the most familiar with the local terrain, so Sällström turned to him with his most pressing question. What do we do, Mohammed? He asked. Kafaji didn't hesitate. We go in again, he said. What? Sällström was incredulous. If you don't go today, we'll never go, Kafaji said. They'll know they can frighten us and your mission will be over. Sällström sat thinking quietly. He was being asked to send his team back down a road where a waiting sniper was merely the only threat of which they were absolutely certain. Okay, he said, we go in. Moments later, the Toyotas lined up again for a fresh attempt to cross into rebel territory. This one would look markedly different. Rather than cautiously feeling their way through no man's land, they would dash across it like inmates on a prison break. Kafaji grabbed a spare armor jacket and, scooting down into a seat, used his feet to press it up against the windshield. Team members in the other cars did the same. When everyone was ready, the SUV passed through a checkpoint and tore down a narrow road with as much speed as the drivers could muster. The vehicle shot across the bridge and did not slow down until all four were on the other side. This time, no shots were fired. Evidence is found and collected. And as history records, no missiles flew. Instead, a deal was struck, a deal to do something that had never been attempted and which sounded pretty much impossible. There would be no missiles if Syria would submit to the removal and the destruction of its entire chemical arsenal, its main strategic weapon system, in 9 months, in the middle of a war. In the book, we get a glimpse of how the deal came together and why. We watch as an international team is hastily assembled to oversee this mammoth task, guided by this remarkable Dutch diplomat, Sigrid Kaag. Sigrid is a UN official who has no military experience and no familiarity with chemical weapons, but she has the mental toughness to go head to head with the leaders of Syria's notoriously brutal and very much male-dominated regime. She quickly discovers that no one really thinks that Syria will give up its weapons, and many countries would prefer to see the deal collapse altogether. Yet she persists and keeps the disarmament mission on task, despite challenges and threats, including occasional mortar fire and artillery fire, and in one instance, a shell that tears through the top floors of her hotel that she's staying in and lands in a bedroom a few floors above her. And yet, in spite of these close calls, she sticks with it and she succeeds. Syria's declared stockpile, which ended up being about 90 to 95% of Assad's total arsenal, plus his production equipment, is destroyed or hauled to a harbor where it could be taken out to sea. And yet, when it's over, Sigrid can't quite bring herself to be happy about it. "I hope the people of Syria can forgive us," she tells a friend. "We didn't change their lives." But getting the weapons out of Syria is only half the struggle. What do you do next? Who will take the weapons and neutralize them? The answer is, no one. The Pentagon has its Margarita machines, but it had no place to put them. No country, including the United States, was willing to open a port to let a toxic cargo like this one come in. With literally no other options, the Pentagon decides that Tim Blades' Margarita machines will be bolted onto the deck of an old cargo ship, and Blades will be placed in charge of what would become the world's first floating chemical weapons destruction factory operating in the middle of the Mediterranean. This was not an optimal solution. A ship at sea is constantly moving and flexing. The entire vessel pitches and rolls with the sea swell. Pipes and hoses get stretched and pulled. A big storm or a rogue wave could overturn equipment or even the ship itself. Experts at the Pentagon called the idea harebrained. But in early 2014, the ship was the only option that remained. And so Tim Blades and his Maryland crew, most of them professed landlubbers, totally inexperienced at sea, climb aboard the motor vessel Cape Ray to began a feat that had literally never been tried in history. There are challenges, including some big ones. There's a major equipment malfunction. Then comes a leak. Parts wear out because of the corrosive nature of the chemicals. And as the work progresses, the ship becomes increasingly unstable because fuel is being burned off, and the fuel is ballast, and the boat becomes top-heavy, prompting real concerns about the possibility of capsizing. Meanwhile, news stories about this chemical weapons ship spinning circles in the Mediterranean sparks outrage across southern Europe, and some of the opponents begin to organize. A flotilla of private vessels, protest ships, departs from Crete to hunt down the Cape Ray. Somehow, it all works. After 42 days, the last of the barrels of deadly chemicals is destroyed. A congratulatory email from one of the team members puts it like this: 5 months to create the first ever field deployable hydrolysis system, 66 days to outfit the vessel, 42 days to destroy hundreds of metric tons of Syria's most dangerous chemicals at sea, the number we will never know, the number of men, women, and children in Syria who were saved from death by chemical weapons. So here, at least for a moment, was a cause for celebration and a quantifiable success, but it's a mixed success, one that is quickly overshadowed by other problems, including the continuing and unrelenting human tragedy in Syria itself. For the international community, there are failures that are apparent for all to see, and they overshadow even successes like this one. Syria's dictator lost his strategic stockpile, the crowning achievement of Syria's military establishment. But Assad did not lose all his weapons. Some were hidden away to be used again, as we see in the book. More importantly, Assad never abandoned his intention to use them. Despite the humiliation of the disarmament deal, and even after later military strikes by the Trump administration, he continued to use his chemical weapons along with every other weapon in his arsenal, from barrel bombs to artillery shells. Assad also was never punished for his war crimes. He continued to use chemical weapons along with every other weapon that he could, as long as he could get away with it. He never faced a moment of accountability because Russia, his ally, had his back. Because of all of this, the international taboo against chemical weapons has suffered a serious weakening. Other actors took notice of Assad's flouting of international law, and they drew their own lessons. ISIS launched an ambitious program to make its own chemical weapons, with significant successes until it was shut down by the US military. Within 3 years of this chemical weapons milestone, Russia and North Korea both would use chemical weapons in assassination attempts outside their borders. And so the safeguards are weakened. The erosion of this 100-year-old taboo continued, just as the suffering continued in Syria, this tragic country, this place where so many Americans would just prefer to forget, this place that has been the source of so much anguish for so many, and yet very possibly could have been, if we can imagine such a thing, even worse. Thank you for your time and attention. I'd be happy to take a few questions.
Joby, the book is harrowing, it's thrilling to read, and it's an incredible story. One of my favorite parts of the book was, and you mentioned the man who runs the chemical part of this place, who created the machine, the margarita mixer. Would you give us a little more background, just sort of set the stage for the Edgewood Chemical Biological Center and tell us its significance in the story and maybe something that's quirky about it that we might want to know?
Yeah, well, he's a neighbor in a way, because pretty much anybody who's driven, you know, toward Baltimore has passed through Edgewood, which is this area that's pretty close to the Maryland border. It's an army outpost that back in World War I was a testing ground for chemical weapons. People forget sometimes that the United States had its own stockpile. We used them in World War I when everyone did. Then we built a massive stockpile during the Cold War, every kind of weapon imaginable, huge numbers of them. And this place in Edgewood, Maryland was a place where these weapons were tested. Later on, when we decided to make a deal with the Russians and get rid of our own stockpile, guys like Ten Blades come into the picture, and they're hired to essentially clean up the damage, clean up these old arsenals, and not just the bombs and missiles themselves, but all the spills and all the waste products. And just, it was a terrible environmental situation. And that's kind of where Tim gets his start in life. And he's the kind of guy that's pretty fearless. And this is why he manages to get himself hurt a couple of times when he's young. In one instance, he's trying to clean up an old sarin stockpile, and he's inside of an enclosed facility where there's a small leak, and everyone gets contaminated. And he runs out, and he realizes that he's been stricken by this. He starts to describe this feeling of like having an elephant sitting on your chest. He can't breathe. He feels like he's probably going to die. But because he happens to be in a place where people know how to handle these conditions, he gets immediate treatment and he survives. But he never forgets what it was like to be exposed to sarin. And so these many years later, when people die in Syria because of this same chemical, he feels deeply that he wants to do something about it. And so that's why, the story of him, building the equipment, operating the machinery that physically destroys the place, it's very meaningful for him and for his crew.
Here's a question that's come in. Would a full-scale military assault by the U.S. have been sufficient to defeat the Assad regime? Obama drew that red line. And
sure. A full-scale military assault probably was what they would have been required in this case. But I think it's pretty clear that never would have happened. People expected that Obama would perhaps launch some airstrikes. Some are hoping they would declare a no-fly zone. Both are require some resources, particularly no-fly zone, which can be sort of an indefinite feature, as we saw in Iraq, and continues for years and becomes very expensive. The idea of sending another wave of American troops into another Middle East country for an open-ended conflict was just not going to fly, had no support among Republicans or Democrats. So that was off the table. The question then becomes, does America strike? And if it does strike, does that do any good? We can actually compare what happened under Obama with what happened under Trump, because Obama's planned military strike in 2013 is pretty much the same one that Trump carried out in 2017 when he was responding to a violation of the red line. And what we saw was a few runways were damaged, some planes were destroyed, a couple of people were killed, not very many. The damage to Assad's military was fairly minimal. His airport was up and running again the same day. We tipped off the Russians in advance, so they got out the back door and none of them were killed. And then he continued to use chemical weapons after that. So it wasn't chastened. He didn't learn any lessons. He didn't really suffer any serious damage. The other thing we can't do, it turns out, is to actually strike chemical weapons stockpiles. You can't do that, because if you drop a bomb on a on a bunker full of sarin, you're just going to end up spreading it. And you may end up killing people that you intended to save. So it's a very hard choice. I think Obama probably would have struck if circumstances had been different. In the end, this deal is dangled, and it's an opportunity to do something that's very much in America's strategic interest, which is getting rid of a major weapon of mass destruction in the Middle East. So he took that gamble, hoping that it would work. And it was somewhat successful, we've seen. It didn't completely work, but it got something very bad out of the Middle East that could have done a lot of damage.
Here's a good follow-on question to that. Tom writes, it is highly suspected, if not established, that Russia has significant stockpiles of chemical weapons. In light of that, what was Russia's position on the disarming of its ally, Syria, in 2013? Is there any concern that Russia is willing to supply such weapons to Syria today?
That's a real good question. So Russia historically has had chemical weapons. We know they did during the Cold War. We also know that they didn't get rid of all of them. One reason we know that is because they've continued to use them in recent years. We've seen now two different assassination attempts using Novichok, which is an extremely dangerous nerve agent, against, in one case, a defector who was in Britain, and more recently against a political opposition figure. So they have this stuff. They maintain their stockpiles. They use it when they feel like they can get away with it. So all that's very much true. On the other hand, it's interesting to see the Russians react to Syria's use of chemical weapons, because in a way, you know, Syria is their ally, Assad is their friend, and they're embarrassed by these continuing reports in the world media about these chemical atrocities. And so it does seem that they were happy enough to see the pressure brought to bear against Assad, so we would have to get rid of most of the stuff at least, and stop being such a problem for them. Later on, though, after the bulk of the stockpile is removed, they end up, having Assad's back for everything. They refuse to let him be, held to account at the UN. They refuse to let him face punishment at the World Criminal Court. So it's protected again and again by the Russians, including eventually in 2015 with arms, with Russian airplanes, with Russian boots on the ground. And it's clear now in hindsight that Russia was willing to do whatever it needed to do to keep their guy in power. For Russia's, vital security interests, Assad was a major player. They had to keep him, in power at all costs, and that's eventually what they did.
Can you elaborate a bit on why Assad is so important to Russia and Syria and its geography?
Yeah, in some ways, it doesn't make sense to us on the outside. It's this small, country. Why would Russia expend so much of its resources to prop this guy up? There are a couple of reasons. One is, Syria is home to the only warm water port, Navy port, for Russia in the world. So they have a major port operation there for their Navy vessels. It's an intelligence gathering place for them. So they have their listening outposts there. So they want to keep and preserve that at all costs. But it also for Russia, it was a chance to kind of flex their muscle it sort of in the Putin era. There had never been a foreign military excursion by Russia since Afghanistan until Syria happened. Here was a chance for Russia to prove how good its weapons are, how it's able to make deals, how it's able to influence events in the Middle East. And you see Russia, by 2016, becoming a major power broker in the region. All the countries of the region, the Israelis, the Jordanians, the Iraqis, everyone has to talk to the Russians, because now they're the ones that control what happens in this part of the region. And so it's a great, a feather in Putin's cap that he's become this international statesman, this deal maker on the world stage, and it's all because of what he's able to do in Syria. It becomes very important to Putin personally.
And why is Syria so important to Iran?
Iran is the other big strategic partner of Syria. They have a relationship that goes back decades. Even though their belief system is different, Iran is a Shiite republic. Assad is an Alawite, which is a kind of many Shiites consider them to be heretics. But this is a marriage of convenience. They both hate the Israelis, and they form this alliance. What we see during the course of the civil war is Syria becomes more and more dependent on the Iranians, because the Iranians are providing money, weapons, ammunition, and eventually troops. They allow Hezbollah, this militia next door in Lebanon, to become active fighters on the Assad side. They start sending their own generals, including Qasem Soleimani, the famous general who was killed in a military strike a couple of years ago. So it is also in Iran's strategic interest to make sure the Assad regime survives. And this is really what the opposition in Syria is up against. It's against a regime that is so brutal it's willing to destroy its country, willing to kill pretty much everybody in order to stay in power, and it has two powerful allies that are just committed to seeing them stay. So absent a major military intervention by the West, it's hard to imagine, you know, how things might have been very different.
Judy asks, with regard to the chemicals, after they were neutralized, where did the waste go?
And that's a good question. So that's controversial as well, because anybody who's familiar with, you know, environmental issues in this country, nobody wants toxic chemicals of any kind. And once you destroy the sarin, you actually are still left with some pretty nasty stuff. It's no worse than the things you see, you know, going down the interstates in some of these, you know, hazmat containers, but it is still bad stuff. And so the United Nations brokered arrangements with multiple countries, the Finns, the Germans, the British, everybody agreed to take some of it. And so in that sense, it became this really big international operation. So after the sarin was neutralized, that big ship, the Cape Ray, goes around Spain, crosses the English Channel, and then starts dropping off its cargo in one port after another until it's all gone.
What organizations do you believe have done the most helpful work in Syria and or for refugees?
There are a number that have been great. You think of, you know, every, you know, once from the Red Cross, the major aid organizations, all the UN agencies that are involved in this work. There's a problem in Syria, and it's and when you talk to people that are in this community, you hear about it all the time, is that, you know, Syria controls the country, except for those few places where there's essentially rebel enclaves. It can dictate where aid goes. And so as much as we perhaps would like to help the most needy people in Syria, often the resources, the money, the food supplies, the medicine goes to people who are Assad loyalists. And so that's been a chronic problem, you know, for these agencies since the beginning. The other issue, or the other groups that are really important, are the ones that are documenting, you know, human rights crimes. Human Rights Watch, there are a number of others that are in the country, have assets on the ground to try to build a case that hopefully one day will be used to be brought before a war court, and we can hope in some way that Assad will be brought to justice. But that's, you know, something that we can't really envision happening in the near future, but it's important to gather the evidence so someday it can be used.
Did the cases that were, I guess it's Open Society and a couple of other groups are bringing, do you think those are going to go through, and what will the ultimate effect of those be, because they're in French and German courts?
Yeah, that's right. So there are actual active court cases that are in Europe right now. And for now, it's more symbolic than anything else. Nobody expects that Assad or any of his family members are going to be brought to court anytime soon. But eventually it could happen. Circumstances can change. And we saw that, you know, in the Balkans conflicts, that eventually some of the serious perpetrators were brought to justice, and they had to serve time in prison. So you can't discount the possibility that someday there will be some accountability. It's just hard to imagine it happening very soon.
What leverage or levers do you see that can get this guy out?
Well, one has to hope that there will be a moment when some of Assad's backers, the Russians and the Iranians specifically, may see it to their advantage to bring about a change. Because Syria, even though, you know, Assad has won in the sense that he's remained in power, he's retained control over the cities in Syria and most of the countryside, the country itself is a mess and the economy is in free fall. You know, there's unrest in the cities, not from opposition groups as much as just ordinary Syrians who can't figure out how to live in the current environment. So you could imagine a scenario where Russia may say, well, let's broker a deal so we can get some international cooperation in rebuilding the country. We can find somebody who's a, you know, an acceptable replacement for Assad. So that is, you know, it's something that could potentially happen. Again, that's not really on the table right now. I can imagine that's something that the Biden folks would love to look for, but it's more theoretical now than anything else.
Well, speaking of the Biden folks, can you talk a bit about the recent bombing of Iran and Syria and how that triangulates with an attempt to get Iran back to the table, and also how that plays into the recalibration of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, it's been interesting to see the Biden folks making their first forays in this arena, because it's there's been a lot of questioning about what exactly Biden will do. This is a time of testing for any new president. You'll certainly see the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians try to test Biden to see how he responds to pressure. It happens with every new president. What we've seen in Syria and Iraq in recent weeks is some of the pro-Iranian militia groups creating provocations, launching artillery rockets on military installations, in one case, killing a U.S. contractor, injuring a serviceman. And so I think for Biden, this is an opportunity to show resolve, to show firmness. These are American facilities and individuals that were targeted, and he wants to put out the message that we're not going to stand for that. So you saw this fairly limited, measured response on basically a single outpost by one of these pro-Iranian militia groups in eastern Syria. It killed a number of people, took out some buildings, and sent the message that, you know, we're not going to stand for this kind of stuff. That's just a small aspect of our potential involvement over there. I think the Biden folks would like to ramp up our engagement diplomatically, the opportunities to work with the Russians and others to try to bring more stability, to do something about refugee flows. So there are opportunities there. And I think they also recognize a need to stay engaged on the ground to a limited degree, because here is a place that, you know, in the eastern part of Syria, it's become essentially an Iranian enclave. There are pro-Iranian militias that control, some of the border crossings. They are loyal to the Iranians. They're right on Israel's doorstep. And so there is a real need for Americans to stay involved, to make sure that bad things don't happen, to make sure that ISIS doesn't come roaring back as it's trying to do. So it is important for us to stay engaged and stay in the region to some degree.
One of the viewers asks, who would Assad choose as his own successor, and how will the next president be decided?
I think if there was an easy answer to that, we might have seen it happen. There was a period of time in around 2012 when things were looking probably the shakiest for Assad, and there was a search to who might be an acceptable replacement. You know, for the last, 30 years, this has been a family dynasty. Before Bashar al-Assad, it was his father, Hafez al-Assad. So it's remained in the family. It's not clear who among the other Assads in Syria would be ready to step into that role. So could it be someone who's, a military officer who has some credibility with others outside Syria, with opposition groups? Perhaps that's an alternative. There's not an obvious person that's kind of standing in the wings ready to take over of that responsibility.
Circling back to the book, Tom asks, while it makes sense that no one wanted to take the sarin to destroy it after it was removed from Syria, did the involved countries really think it was safer to destroy this at sea, or was it an international NIMBY?
It was more the latter, to be honest. And there was an effort by the Americans and by the UN to try to find another place. And it was a very intense period where we went to the Europeans, went to the Russians first, because the Russians, we remember, had their own chemical weapons stockpile, which they have mostly destroyed now, if not entirely, the old chemical stuff. And so they have very expensive facilities they built for this very purpose. It would be very easy for these chemicals to be put on a ship, sent through the Black Sea. Russia takes them and destroys them in its own facilities, but Russia wouldn't do that. So then we turned to the French and to the Belgians, who have facilities that can handle it. We went to the Albanians, of all places, because Albania was a country at the time that was seeking NATO membership. Strategically, they were close by. They could potentially allow these margarita machines to be set up on a port or at some empty field somewhere. It just didn't really require that much real estate. And that was about to happen until news leaked out that Albania's leaders were about to accept this stuff. And the entire country erupted in protest. You saw people, in the streets by the tens of thousands, demanding that this thing be stopped and protesting any possibility of chemical weapons coming into their country. And so Albania is off the table. So when all those other folks said no, there was really no option. We had the chemical weapons were coming out of Syria. They're on the way to the port. And we had no place for them to go. So the only option that was left in December of 2013 was to put this machine on a boat. And as kind of bad, it is not plan A, B, or C, it's plan Z. But that was what they had. And they thought that, well, we can reinforce the equipment. We can make sure that there are flexible joints and pipes and backup plans and containment equipment in case there is a spill. And so they try to imagine every contingency where things might go wrong, but then they were just forced to do it. And in a way, they got lucky. I mean, the weather was good. The equipment, you know, faltered, but it worked eventually. And in 42 days, they did what they set out to do, which is destroy the chemicals on the boat.
Is that boat still available? And are those Margarita machines still functional in case we need them again?
They are still around. The machines are very much available. And in fact, when they were first designed, and it wasn't clear that they would ever be used, you know, the Pentagon looked at them and said, wow, this is a no-brainer. We should have these anyway. So they were put in a warehouse and they could be used in the future if the circumstances arise. The Cape Ray, after this mission ended, and after the last of the chemicals were destroyed, the crew pretty much got off the boat. They got on planes and went back home. And then the Cape Ray starts heading back to Norfolk, where it's based. And on the way back, its engine breaks down. So after all that drama and all the things that could have gone wrong, once the mission is over, that's the moment that things really start to fall apart for the boat. It does go back home. There's a period of weeks of scrubbing the thing down to make sure there are no traces of any of these toxic chemicals left. It was inspected and certified to be safe. And now it's put back in what's called the U.S. Ready Reserve Fleet, which is this, you know, fleet of vessels that are on standby in case we need them in a future war. And that's where it is today, down in Portsmouth, Virginia at this moment.
Okay, that makes sense. Larry asks, where does Turkey play now in Syria, as well as with Iran and others? And did they do anything concrete on the gassing issue, or were they all talk?
The Turks were quite concerned about the gas issue, and they ended up, you know, being so close to some of the early incidents, the early chemical weapons attacks, that some of the victims actually went into Turkey for treatment. And early in the book, I describe one of these. There's a woman who was in this border town who gets a whiff of sarin because a helicopter drops these little canisters of sarin over this town. One of them falls in her backyard. She goes out to investigate, and this thing is there. She gets a breath of sarin, ends up getting very sick, and her family takes her across to Turkey for treatment, and she dies there. Because her body is physically in Turkey, the Turks can conduct an autopsy, and then they allow the UN to come in and conduct their own autopsy and gather samples. And this was the first hard evidence that the West had that sarin was being used. So after that, you see the Turks, you know, very much riled up about this possibility and very much in support of the idea of getting the stuff out of the region. Their contributions were not very impressive, I must say. There are some Turkish officials, diplomats, who were involved on the UN or the OPCW level, but as a country, they didn't really contribute very much. Turkey plays, even to this day, you know, a very sort of precarious role. It supports the opposition, including some of the Islamist opposition in northern Syria. It's opposed to the Assad regime. But it's also, you know, opposed to the Kurds, who we're allies with, the ones who partnered with us in defeating ISIS, and they see them as terrorists. So it's extremely delicate, you know, multifaceted relationship that the Biden folks will now have to try to navigate, because it's really difficult to find solutions that make all these different parties happy, and it sort of defies, you know, diplomatic solutions in the traditional sense.
A few stray questions here. What is the name of the spy that you mentioned, and is he still alive or was he found out? Okay.
Yeah, this is the Ayman character in the beginning. It's actually the prologue to the book, and I only use his last name, or sorry, his first name. I do know his name, but there was fear that because his family is out of Syria now, there could be reprisals against them. So I agreed not to use his last name. So he was killed. You'll see in the book that he's ends up being betrayed in a peculiar way. It's a bit inadvertent, but he does get himself in serious trouble and pays a terrible price. And as you read the book, you'll understand what I mean. But yeah, he's no longer with us. But he did help the CIA for about 14 years before sort of the gravy train ended, as it were.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought of him more as a mole than a spy. Somebody asked, is there acrimony or reliance deference with Iran's Muslim clerics?
So it's, you know, it's an interesting relationship. It's clearly the Iranians need Assad. You know, he's very important to them. You know, Syria is their closest ally, really anywhere, and so they support him. They prop him up, but at the same time they're frustrated with him. You know, this, you know, Iran is a theocracy essentially. It's ruled by religious leaders. Syria is not that. Syria was more of a secular, you know, more of a traditional, you know, dictatorship, a military dictatorship, a thugtocracy, if you know you might call it, just because it's run by very corrupt, very ruthless leaders. But they tolerate each other and with occasional annoyance. You can see the Iranians were actually a bit angry with Assad when he did begin using chemical weapons, because it was something that attracted the attention of the West. It got everybody worked up. It ended up, you know, bringing the UN into Syria in a big way. And so it was very inconvenient for the Iranians. So there was some scolding that went on, we've been reliably told, by the Syrian leaders, or sorry, the Iranian leaders, toward Assad and the others. And yet, as I said, it's an important relationship for both of them, and they depend on each other. And that's why they tolerate each other.
This last question is from somebody who I believe is in the book. His name is Jay, last initial S.
Okay.
What was the thing that surprised you most as you researched this book?
That's a very good question. I think this guy could, my friend here could answer the question brilliantly. For me, I think it was something that a story that he knows well. This is a person who kind of understands how the mission came together that led to the Cape Ray, was just how this mission impossible became something real. Where in the beginning, you know, it was just hard to imagine a scenario where all these pieces could come together so quickly and create the technology to bring the money together, to find the ship, to outfit it, to bring the crews aboard, you know, all this stuff that had to be done in a very compressed period of time, literally just about a month to get all these pieces in place. And the way that was brought about, I really could not do it justice in the book because it was such complexity and so many moving parts to it. But it was just surprising to see how, you know, the bureaucracy, how the Pentagon, how these various players that we don't think about as being the most nimble in the world, in this instance, they all came together and they did their job. And it was almost completely unsung, because when this stuff happened, when the chemicals were removed and destroyed, you know, the attention of the world had moved elsewhere. We were thinking about other problems in Syria. We were thinking about the rise of ISIS, which was just taking over Mosul and declaring the caliphate. The invasion of Crimea, deteriorating relations with Russia. So all these other big problems on the international world stage, and no one really was giving much thought to this almost miraculous effort that went into making those chemicals disappear. And there are a number of people that just worked and worked and worked for months to see that it happened, and they succeeded in the end.
Well, it's a story well told, Joby, and it reads like a thriller, and it's not a secret anymore. The book is called The Red Line, The Unraveling of Syria and America's Race to Destroy the Most Dangerous Arsenal in the World. Joby, good luck with the book. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.